Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as gridlock continues in Washington over the national debt, we'll get a leading Republican view now from Glenn Hubbard, dean of the Columbia University Business School, who was chairman of President Bush's Council of Economic Advisers and was a top Romney campaign advisor last year. He has a new book that puts debt at the center of the collapse of historical empires, including the Roman, the Ottoman, and the British. The book is called Balance: The Economics of Great Powers from Ancient Rome to Modern America. Thanks for coming on, Dean Hubbard. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. My pleasure.
First, on the context of historical comparisons that you make in the book, the Roman Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the British Empire, others, do you see the United States today as an empire?
Well, I certainly see the United States as the preeminent power in the world, hence the comparison. But the comparison in the book is really quite optimistic. The U.S. is not in inevitable decline at all, and I think there's every reason to believe we can get our act together and in 25 years still be on top.
But in the book, you seem to say that debt and less expansionism, the, you know, pulling back on expanding those empires, are the two common factors that brought those historical empires down. Is that the main case you're making?
Yes. What's very interesting is people often think that empires get in trouble by overstretching themselves. Generally, it's the other way around. It's understretch. It's looking too inward. It's disadvantaging your future to advantage your present. That's really what has happened. In the U.S., that's all about the rise of big entitlement programs that really threaten our ability to defend our country, educate our children, and have a better future. We need to make adjustments.
But are you saying cutting government domestic spending is necessary, but increasing military spending, even in the face of the debt?
Not really. I mean, the issue, though, for the U.S. is that military spending isn't the real problem. As a fraction of GDP, it's declined sharply over the past few decades. The issue is the rise of entitlement spending. And the question for the country is that what we want? Do we want to crowd out the ability to do research, to invest in our children, to invest in infrastructure, simply to become an entitlement state? I don't think that's what the American people want.
But before I get off the foreign policy and military aspect, you argue against the conventional wisdom by historian Paul Kennedy in his classic The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, the argument that imperial overreach contributes to empires' economic declines. And you write that imperial underreach, and you just said it, is historically more damaging than imperial overreach. So I wonder what you mean by that in the international sense. Like when you heard President Obama's national security speech last week calling for an end to the perpetual war footing, things like that. Do you cringe and say, wait a minute, this is actually going to hurt us economically?
Well, as an economist, I guess what I would say is what we need to do is project our economic power around the world, the so-called soft power expression. The U.S. still has it and can project it. We also need a more muscular economic policy at home to help everyone succeed in this economy. By thrusting so much of our resources into entitlements, we're hurting our ability both to project ourselves abroad and to empower the next generation.
My guest, Glenn Hubbard, Dean of the Columbia University Business School, Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers for President Bush, a top economics advisor to the Romney campaign, and the author now of Balance, The Economics of Great Powers from Ancient Rome to Modern America. You take many what you might call conservative positions in the book. I wonder if we can go down a few of these for some quick explanations of your position, and some of them relate to your central concern about entitlements. You praise our democracy, but you call government itself the most dangerous faction in America. The United States government is a faction. You argue for a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution, against means testing as a way of shoring up Social Security, but for a flat Social Security payment, same amount to every retiree, regardless of what you put in. You disparage labor and environmental standards and free trade agreements. You say Medicare and Medicaid leave fewer people with health insurance. And you reject the idea that the $1 trillion plus in borrowing for the Iraq and Afghanistan wars when you were in the Bush administration matter much to the debt. So just so people know some of the places you're coming from, can you explain the flat Social Security payment idea?
Well, the idea in Social Security isn't to have a flat payment, but to make the system more progressive by essentially slowing down benefit growth for more affluent retirees. Economists often call that progressive indexation of Social Security benefits. The idea is to focus attention in entitlement programs where it's most needed, on the least well-off among us. America can afford that and still do everything else and still have manageable tax burdens. What we can't afford is the system whose path we're now on.
But what's the difference between what you just said and means testing Social Security benefits depending on your income, which I think people in both parties are starting to embrace as one of the solutions?
What is a kind of means testing? But it wouldn't be literally done on the income the year before you retire. It's done gradually over your lifetime income. So in that sense, it is a form of means testing. The idea behind entitlement reform is if we're going to make fiscal adjustments in the country, the most affluent among us need to bear the most sacrifice. The question is how to do that. And the fairest way to do that, it strikes Tim Kaine, my co-author and me, is to shrink the importance of the entitlement programs for those individuals.
And I have neglected to give Tim Kaine, who's not a guest in this segment, co-author credit. He's the chief economist of the Hudson Institute and has twice served at the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress. Glenn Hubbard and Tim Kaine wrote Balance, the Economics of Great Powers, From Ancient Rome to Modern America. On this muscular global economic policy that you talk about, on free trade, you so dismiss environmental standards in free trade agreements that you call them phytosanitary concerns. You write, quote, "Even the notion of free trade is a bit of a misnomer, subject to an escalating set of conditional restrictions on labor standards, phytosanitary, yes, it's a real word, concerns the health of plants," you write, "and so on. Are we truly as open as we should be for economic growth?" So, I mean, are you like, isn't that funny and obscure that someone might think it in humanity's interest to protect the rainforests? Why do you use the dismissive term phytosanitary concerns?
Actually, you're the one who's dismissive. What we argue in the book is that a healthy environment is most likely to come from a healthy economy. Societies with more rapid economic growth and prosperity are the ones with the resources to take care of the environment, and we continue to see that. The point in the book is that there are a variety of protectionist schemes that hide behind nice-sounding things like environmental policy. We should have a strong global environmental policy, but we shouldn't be carrying it out by screwing up the free trade system that has the ability to make many Americans prosperous and many people around the world prosperous.
The argument on the other side, and I just had Al Gore on the show the other week, who is still staunchly free trade. People remember his debate once upon a time with Ross Perot, who was more protectionist.
Yes, absolutely.
And I asked him if he still holds to that position, even seeing what NAFTA has wrought from other people's perspective and whatever. He says, yes, absolutely, Al Gore, pro-free trade. But he said because labor and environmental standards have become strong enough to protect what needs to be protected. And the people on the other side from you on this, I guess, like Gore, would say that without labor and environmental standards, free trade agreements promote a race to the bottom. Industry will run to countries with the weakest environmental laws, just like Apple pretends it's based in Ireland for the lowest global tax rates, but that's another story. And the U.S. clothing industry disappears, so we'll get cheap shirts, but they're made in fire traps in Bangladesh. Untrue?
Well, it's certainly the case that business has many reasons for locating around the world. I think if we want to have a strong global environmental protection policy, and I think we should, we need to carry that out through public policy. We need to have international agreements that are serious about greenhouse gas emissions, serious about incentives for business to innovate around the environment. But doing it through the guise of discouraging trade is going to cost us much more as an economy. That's the point we make in the book.
And I do see in the book that you do take global warming seriously as a threat. Do you support cap and trade, which was once supported by a number of Republicans as well as Democrats, as a market-based way to take carbon emissions into account? Because that was how it was originally sold, was this is a market solution because you're going to set the total cap that the atmosphere can endure, and then the market goes about figuring out who gets to use those emissions.
Yeah, the original market-based solutions were cap-and-trade systems. If you think of the SO2 system from the early 90s, very much a cap-and-trade system. The issue for a cap-and-trade system in greenhouse gases is that it has to be global and binding everywhere to work. So in principle, yes, if we can get a global agreement at the right level, the question is the leadership to do that. An alternative would be a tax regime, but that too would have to be global to be effective. But yes, I think these policies are very important.
Question from a listener on our webpage. Michael in New Jersey writes, where was he when Medicare Part D was created without a clue as to funding? So
I opposed it.
You did oppose it.
Absolutely. I think that the expansion of Medicare without paying for it was a very serious error. I said so at the time and have continued to say so. The budget mistakes that have been made in our country have been made on both sides of the aisle. They don't wear a Democrat T-shirt or a Republican T-shirt. But as a nation, we have to fix it. The listener's right.
What was that conversation like? As chairman of President Bush's Council of Economic Advisors, were you in the room with other policymakers and you were having robust debates about Medicare Part D?
Well, in fairness to Part D, it did introduce a lot of market mechanisms that enabled it to cost much less than people had originally thought. So my concern wasn't whether or not we should have a drug benefit in Medicare. Arguably, we should. The question is just, as a nation, does it make sense to continue to add to entitlements? We've done so in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act under President Obama. We did so in Medicare Part D under President Bush. I think the nation can't continue to do this unless and until we're willing to pay for it.
And how about the off-budget borrowing for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan during Bush? You minimize in your book the impact of that on the total national debt, but it was over $1 trillion, and these wars were not paid for, they were borrowed for. Were you opposing that too from your perch?
Well, you know, I can't speak to the foreign policy elements of military conflict because it really relates to what your counterfactual is. What would the world have been like without the wars? And I am not a foreign policy expert. I can say that military spending historically, now, going forward, is not the source of America's budget problems. Should we pay more for wars? I think the answer to that generally is, though, yes. Again, as a country, we need to, when we have expansions of government, stand ready to pay for them.
You don't agree with the whole guns versus butter equation, and yet so much money comes out in spending on a war that there's less money for domestic programs. Is there not?
Well, again, I don't think that's the right perturbation to consider. The entitlement programs are an order of magnitude larger than our issues in national defense. And I think the counterfactual is what happens if you don't have those defense expenditures. That's really a question for foreign policy experts. As a country, we kid ourselves. We underscore that. We kid ourselves if we think that cutting defense is a way to get out of the government box we're in. The entire defense budget is just over 3% of GDP.
Of GDP, but as a percentage of the federal government's budget, it's much, much more than that.
Yes, but the question is, how big are the entitlements? In 25 years, the entitlements will be 10 times that. There are already many multiples of that. You could eliminate national defense and have rounding error in future entitlement spending. That's the problem.
There is an emerging alternative view of how the U.S. might grow out of our debt problem. It's partly that we're the Saudi Arabia of natural gas, and the natural gas boom will soon lead us with a high rate of growth that will also let us pull back from military entanglements with the oil-rich Middle East. We see California, which, you know, you criticize as unsustainably liberal in its state spending, now with a surplus. The federal deficit has been cut in half through maybe some unexpected growth. What do you think of all these things?
Well, I share your optimism on the energy front. It's one of the great and many reasons to be optimistic about our country's future. It requires a different regulatory policy than we have now, but it can absolutely lead both to faster growth and to improved national security. We can't grow our way out of the entitlements, though. They're, not to get too much into the weeds, they're indexed to productivity growth. So if we grow faster, we'll just wind up spending more. But I certainly share your optimism about the future. With California and the U.S., I would advise you not to be too dismissive of long-term problems just because you have a near-term move. The CBO, Congressional Budget Office, barely moved its 10-year deficit numbers, and beyond 10 years finds the deficit still exploding. So good news in a year doesn't a lifetime make.
Glenn Hubbard, co-author of Balance, The Economics of Great Powers from Ancient Rome to Modern America. Hey, in 10 seconds, if you can do it, people might be surprised to hear that the dean of the Columbia University Business School is positioned the way you are. What percentage of the B-School grads from Columbia do you think agree with your basic worldview when they graduate?
I don't know. I think the business school grads just have a basic worldview about business. I don't know that they're particularly political one way or the other.
All right. Dean Hubbard, thank you very much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.